This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It sounds like the script for a movie. A man contracts a form of tuberculosis, but he feels and looks fine, so despite advice from the county health service to stay put, he decides to go ahead with his long-planned wedding in Greece. Just after he leaves, public health officials learn the disease is XDR-TB, rare, very difficult to treat, highly resistant to drugs, and deadly. The Centers for Disease Control tracks the man down on his honeymoon in Rome. They say they plan to fly him back home on their plane. He says they were going to put him in isolation in Italy indefinitely, and the couple bolts. We just wanted to come home and get treatment, he told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution later. Evading a no-fly order, they get on a flight to Montreal, drive to New York, and he goes to a hospital. The man, still unidentified, is under federal quarantine with an armed guard outside the door of his hospital room near Atlanta. The CDC has issued an international health alert, and questions pile up. What are the chances that the passengers or staff on those transatlantic flights are infected? Why wasn't he prevented from flying? What was his obligation once he knew he was sick? Who's to blame if somebody else does get sick? Call us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, Fred Thompson decides to run the repercussions from the passage of the Iraq War funding bill. Is this the Democrats' war now? And Republicans, home for the Memorial Day recess, face hostile questions on immigration. If you have questions for the political junkie, you can email them now. Again, the address is talk@npr.org. But first, the man with XDR-TB. Joining us now is Dr. Michael Eisman, a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, where he specializes in pulmonary and infectious diseases. He joins us from his office at the National Jewish Medical and Research Center in Denver, Colorado. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And XDR-TB stands for Extreme Drug-Resistant Tuberculosis. Can you explain what that is?
It is a reference to the fact that the organism is resistant not only to the two drugs that defined MDR-TB, the scourge of the 1990s, but now resistant to more of the standard drugs. And it really represents a therapeutic challenge of immense dimensions.
And as I understand it, though, the good news is it's not as easily transmitted as we might fear.
This individual case seems not to be at great risk for transmission. The markers of transmission most prominently are a positive sputum smear test, where we can identify the organisms in the expectorated sputum. This individual apparently was negative under the microscope, and that lessens the risk of transmission by almost an order of magnitude, but it's still a measurable and in this case, an ominous threat.
And ominous because if it is transmitted, look out.
Exactly.
It's deadly.
Well, it is an immense challenge to modern TB therapy. My institution, the National Jewish Hospital, has been caring for patients similar to this for the last 30 years, and we have encouraging success for an individual such as this, but in much of the world where there's not access to the exotic retreatment drugs, we don't have access to the excellent surgical support we enjoy, it is predictably lethal.
Mm. And as I understand it, this man, still unidentified for obvious reasons, but he may be headed your way.
There have been discussions about referring him here for therapy. Our experience, I think, is unique in respect that several respects. We have, I think, the best laboratory in the world for identifying drugs that might be active against this particular strain of TB. We have a laboratory that helps us quantitate the amount of medicines we give, so we are not going to intoxicate the patient with our medicines, but give enough medicines to be effective. And then finally, we have really a spectacular support surgical service.
As I understand it, and this according to an article that was published in today's Atlanta Journal-Constitution, he said, look, I he had set up a plan to go to Denver to have this treated when he got back from his honeymoon, and then all of this drama erupted when he decided to go ahead and go to Greece and get married as he planned long to do.
I really shouldn't, am not qualified. I'm familiar with some of the publish information about the case, but I don't know the details of it, and I don't think it would be appropriate for me to comment about the extent to which he knew of the risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me then ask about what the extent of the risk might be, as far as you know. Medically, from what we're told by the Centers for Disease Control, what they're concerned about is maybe the passengers who were flying with him in his row and maybe the two rows around him, they might be at risk.
TB is spread by airborne transmission of the infectious bacterium. When a patient coughs, the bacteria can be disseminated in the air. And as they drift farther away from the patient, the concentration of the infectious particles goes down. So the individuals who are in close proximity to the individual case are at greatest risk. Domestic air travel doesn't constitute a measurable risk because of the factor of time. But there have been clear cases where drug-resistant and other forms of TB have been spread on international travel of 8 hours, such as the trips that this individual made.
And if you were a flight attendant on that flight, might you have concerns as well?
Yes. The studies have shown that flight attendants are at relatively greater risk cumulatively just because of the time they spend in the cabin. I don't want to overrepresent the risk. On the other hand, I think the CDC's approach to aggressive public health investigation is right on.
So they're trying to find anybody who might have been on those flights. And if they were in the immediate vicinity, they will be tested. If they were not in the immediate vicinity, they can be tested if they want to, as far as I understand it.
The individuals who might reasonably consider themselves to be at greatest risk might be someone whose immune system has been compromised, an individual with HIV infection, an individual with organ transplantation, an individual who's received cancer chemotherapy that might have recently impacted their immune system. That's an individual who clearly would want to be evaluated.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on this conversation. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Right now we're talking with Dr. Michael Eisman, a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And joining us now on the line from Philadelphia is Alfred.
Hello.
Alfred, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. My question is why it is that there has been so much publicity to this incident, when in fact it has caused a great deal of consternation and difficulty among people all over the country, as though we are about to have a widespread epidemic of this particular viral disease. I can take my answer off the air, but I really find it counterproductive to have so much publicity about this single incident. The question, I guess, really is, what is the threat to the general population? I'll be glad to take my...
And thanks for the call, Alfred.
This situation might be reasonably compared with the epidemic of SARS, which really generated wide-scale panic around the world. And clearly, the likelihood of any individual being exposed to this TB case is relatively low. And you might arguably say that that there's been overreaction. But you have to understand that the public health obligation to the community is such that the information has to be disseminated. Were the authorities to have not taken action, not have notified the individuals who might have been exposed, they would have been at risk of severe criticism if a case of XDR-TB had evolved. So it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. I certainly agree that the public should not be made to feel panic, however, the public health proceedings are absolutely correct, in my opinion.
Well, the case also brings up some relatively arcane legal issues. Joining us now is Wendy Parmet. She's a Matthews Distinguished Professor of Law at Northeastern University and an expert on health disability and public health law. She's with us today from the studios of our member station in Boston, WBUR. Nice to have you on the program.
Good afternoon. I'm glad to be here.
And the man was placed under federal quarantine, the first such order, as far as anybody can remember, in, I think, 40 years.
Yes, the federal quarantine power has been used very, very rarely in recent memory. States and local governments have quarantined people somewhat more frequently, but still, even that's unusual. Quarantine is really a power that has been used much more in the past than in recent decades.
What kind of evidence does somebody need before they can be placed under federal quarantine? And who issues such an order? Is it a judge? Is it the president? Who?
Well, the president has authority to list the quarantinable diseases and to decide which diseases are subject to the federal quarantine power. And the president has done that, and tuberculosis is one of those diseases. The Centers for Disease Control is issuing the quarantine order, but one of the things that is unclear under federal quarantine law is, because it is old and because it has been used relatively, again, basically not in 40 years, is the process by which this is carried out and the role of courts in issuing or reviewing orders is really not all spelled out right now. We know much more about how the process works at the state level than we do at the federal level.
So if this man got a lawyer and a habeas corpus order, could he try to get a habeas corpus order?
Absolutely. He could try to bring a habeas corpus. That is the historical approach for seeking review of detention when the process is not given. And he certainly could claim that his constitutional rights have been violated or are subject to review.
Because he's sitting in a hospital room with an armed guard outside the door and understandably a little concerned.
Absolutely. I mean, we don't know all the facts right now, but we don't know whether he's been given legal process, whether he's been given access to an attorney, and his basic constitutional rights. I'm not saying, by the way, that he hasn't been.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly has constitutional rights, and habeas corpus would be the approach that most lawyers would use to review the detention.
We're going to talk more about some of the legal questions and the medical questions surrounding this very unusual case of extremely rare tuberculosis. A man has been placed under federal quarantine outside of Atlanta, Georgia. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We'll get to our conversation with the political junkie a little later this hour. If you have questions for Ken Rudin about Iraq spending, immigration, Fred Thompson, or the rest of the week's political news, drop us an email now, talk@npr.org. But now we're talking about the unidentified man in Georgia who's been diagnosed with a rare form of tuberculosis and put under federal quarantine. Our guests are Dr. Michael Eisman, professor of medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and Wendy Parmet, an expert on health, disability, and public health law, and the Matthews Distinguished Professor of Law at Northeastern University. If you have questions about this particular form of TB or what obligations someone has once they're diagnosed with a contagious disease, give us a call, 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Here's an email question from Larry in Minneapolis. Is this case much like the resistant cases that Dr. Paul Farmer worked on successfully in Peru, or is this a more severe and more resistant strain of TB? Dr. Eisman?
This is similar to the cases in Peru. I actually worked with Dr. Farmer and visited Lima and looked at the program there, and it has several features. What XDR-TB represents is the next step in the evolution of the resistance. XDR-TB signifies resistance to two of the major drugs used in treating cases with MDR-TB, the cases from Peru, and it just raises the degree of difficulty of cure. It lessens the likelihood of cure. It increases the need for surgery. It really raises the bar substantially.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Kayleen. Kayleen's with us from Indiana.
Yes, this is Kayleen.
Go ahead, please.
But anyways, I was wondering, can he be charged with manslaughter if someone got infected or, you know, got a strain of it or some premeditated, some form of murder under law?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wendy Parmet, what's his legal obligation or what's his legal liability if somebody, in the unlikely event that he did infect somebody?
Well, I think we need to know much more than we know about exactly what did he know. And I gather that there's some controversy about what he was told to do. But It would be extraordinarily unusual to find that someone was guilty of manslaughter. There have been some cases that have been brought with infectious disease, but there really needs to be great clear intent and knowing that he put someone at harm. His civil liability is more substantial. The intent level is reduced under the law, but again, he is pretty much, we will need to know that he understood that he was placing people at risk, and that's not completely clear. The other thing I should say is, of course, there are jurisdictional issues here since much of the contact was done, it appears, outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm. What about for future people who will, you know, who's going to think they can break the law and not get and kind of get away with it? It seems this case here.
Well, it's not clear that he broke the law at all, in at least any law in terms of a criminal law or a order. I understand that Dr. Gerbeding has claimed that there was no order. He didn't follow recommendations, but that's not breaking
the law. Well, that was on his way out of the country. On his way back when he was in Rome, he was apparently told, look, don't fly. And then he went and flew.
But that's not clear that that was a legal order that they had.
I see. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I wonder, is either the county public health office or that handled this case initially, or the CDC, could they be liable if somebody else got infected by this man? Again, the unlikely event that had happened, for not stopping him from flying.
That would be very hard to imagine. We give our public health officials pretty broad immunity in their so-called discretionary functions, and that's clear under the federal law. We don't usually hold government officials liable or government agencies liable for not taking a coercive action against an individual, which then leads to potentially some harm for someone else. Putting him into quarantine, for example, before he left the country in this situation would have been quite unusual and almost unprecedented. And I don't believe that any court would find an official liable.
Now, do you suspect, in fact, that one of the reasons he's in quarantine was because he evaded whatever suggestions, advice, however you want to phrase it, whether it was short of an order or not, but they were concerned that he might be on the move again?
That, again, we don't know the facts, but that appears likely. Almost all of the legal quarantine cases that we know about in the last 15 years or so have been with tuberculosis and have been in cases where the claim has been made and that the individual was non-compliant with the advice of health officials, that the person was not doing what they were asked to do. Health officials asked them not to travel, asked them to stay in the hospital, asked them to take their medications. And it's only, and courts have suggested that it really needs to be shown something like non-compliance. So I assume that that's the case here. But again, all the facts are not out.
Wendy Parmet, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Wendy Parmet, Matthews Distinguished Professor of Law at Northeastern University, an expert on health, disability, and public health law, with us today from member station WBUR in Boston. Osama's on the line. Osama calling us from Detroit.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to try to keep this as untechnical as possible, but from my understanding, there has been a trend that has been known for the past decade in the resistance of microbes, such as the trends we've seen in hospitals with MRSA, and mycobacterium now, and one of the causes of this is the microbes' resistance to drug use, and this occurs with successive microbial generations. And we've known about this for a decade now, and we've had the data from South America, and what I'm wondering now is how often has there been a change in the standardized use of certain treatments, and how often or when will we see another paradigm shift in the way such antibiotic treatments are administered.
Mm-hmm. If I could summarize for those of us even less technical, is this strain of XDR-TB a result of overuse of antibiotics, Dr. Eisman?
It really doesn't represent overuse. It almost always originates with inappropriate use. It either means that the prescribing physician did not administer a sufficient number of drugs, did not administer the appropriate dose of the medications, or the patients chose to take the red pill but not the white pill, and in some way subverted the logic of multiple drug therapy. TB is the essential paradigm of multiple drug therapy. It was recognized in the 1950s that if we gave a single drug, the organisms would mutate and become resistant, and we recognized then that three drugs had to be given in order to assure that the organism would be killed and not mutate and become resistant. It took us about a decade in HIV therapy to discover the same principle. And it's really the kind of the holy trinity of treatment of these types of infections. And I don't think it represents overuse of drugs, but inadequate control. The United States was in the midst of an MDR epidemic from 1989 to 1993, and it was highly lethal. And we changed our practices to use directly observed therapy, and it goes back to Ms. Parmet's comments about what quarantine represents. Quarantine in tuberculosis means you're served a notice that says so long as you take the medicines reliably, you will be free to walk about our community, but if you don't, you are subject to being locked up to protect the public from transmission of TB. And it was that approach to TB that reduced drug resistance in the United States dramatically. In 1992, there were 500 cases of MDR-TB. Last year, there were under 100, and it's a clear relationship to having quarantine power, which puts teeth in the practice of public health.
And also, I guess we should point out that the incidence of TB overall is also way down, and the incidence of this exotic form of TB is, I think 50 a year, something like that?
It's a wonderful success story that we should celebrate. America's TB program from 1990 to the present time has been one of the great stories in modern public health. We've cut cases from 10.5 per 100,000 to under 5 per 100,000. We've reduced drug-resistant TB. And it speaks to the power of a well-organized program that has at its root the enforcement capacity for quarantine.
All right. Osama, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you very much.
Exactly what are your obligations to the rest of society when you've been diagnosed with an infectious disease? The man, now under federal quarantine, traveled on two commercial flights earlier this month and may have exposed other passengers. Nancy Cass is the Phoebe Berman Professor of Bioethics and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. She joins us now from the studios of member station WYPR in Baltimore. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And as we've mentioned, there are conflicting stories about what he was told about his disease and whether he could travel or not. But what, if any, are his personal obligations, knowing that he had at least some form of tuberculosis?
It's hard to know. And again, as everyone has said, it's so hard to know what the facts are, and they become so relevant. Certainly, if we imagine someone in a different situation who clearly was told that they absolutely should not travel, and it's not only that they are told that they should not travel, but why they should not travel, namely that they have a disease that potentially could be both contagious and deadly to others, mm-hmm. then he absolutely has a personal moral duty to follow those recommendations, restrictions, however it's framed. But I want to address what you said a minute ago, which is we have a parallel responsibility to him. Mm-hmm. to attend to his needs and well-being to some extent if we, meaning society or the government, are the one who impose a restriction on him for everyone else's benefit.
Aha. Uh-huh. So, but he, again, the facts in this case are not yet totally clear, but he was under treatment and was planning further treatments when he got back from his wedding and his honeymoon. And well, these were long-planned things. Obviously, they were very important to him.
If I may make a comment.
Go ahead, Dr. Osmond.
There clearly is an obligation of the individual to adhere to therapy, and I find it's unique in medicine. There's no other infectious disease that's quarantined like TB because of the risk of casual, innocent sharing of air, unlike hepatitis or HIV that requires intimacy and some complicity in the exposure. TB, because of the specter of sitting in a bus, sitting in a plane, going to a classroom and being exposed to a lethal infection, has given it a unique standing.
Aren't there others that are you know, horrors that could be transmitted that way? A pneumonic plague, for example?
Pneumonic plague certainly could be, but that's usually an individual who's sick unto death in a hospital bed. Bubonic plague was the way it was usually transmitted, by fleas, and the pneumonic plague, while it could be, was so quickly lethal that it didn't pose the enduring day after day, month after month risk of transmission.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Eisman and also with Nancy Cass about the case of the man under federal quarantine with a rare form of tuberculosis. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As we speak, the Centers for Disease Control is holding a news conference this hour. They have not released any more information on the man in this particular case, but they did give some further details on the transatlantic flights that he took and which passengers might be at risk.
The patient sat in seat 12C. This occurred on May 24th from Prague to Montreal on Czech Air flight 0104. There were 191 passengers and 9 crew on this flight. Approximately 30 persons were in that risk area, 2 rows in front, 2 rows behind, who are the highest priority for actively seeking and following up at this point.
That's a bit of the news conference underway at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. We'll continue to monitor that event for any further details or updates. And Dr. Eisman, that seems to relate to what you were talking about earlier.
The experience has been that there tends to be exposure only in the proximity of the seat because of the dilutional effect. If you cough, certainly the air can be distributed in the cabin, but the likelihood of the concentration of infectious particles is closer, proximate to the patient.
Mm. Let's get back to Nancy Cass. Nancy Cass, the head of the CDC, Dr. Julie Gerberding, spoke yesterday on NPR about a covenant of trust between health officials and this patient. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. Public health ethics is always very challenging because we, particularly in the United States, highly value our individual freedoms, our ability to get on airplanes, our ability to go to work. And at the same time, public health has a duty to essentially protect us from each other if there is a threat to the public's health, and also to protect us, obviously, from unsafe restaurants, unsafe water. Part of what comes when you want to both grant people freedoms but protect safety is that you trust people that if they are told that they pose a threat, or if a water source poses a threat, that they will follow the orders necessary. One of the things that we deeply believe in ethics, and our public health departments generally follow this, is a moral requirement for the least restrictive alternative. So what the CDC potentially could have done with this patient or someone like him is immediately put them in jail. I think what Dr. Gerberding is referring to with this covenant of trust is that if we say to someone, there are important public health reasons why your movements need to be restricted, that we value that least restrictive alternative enough to allow them to voluntarily follow that. Obviously, we only take that so far because we have to err on the side of protecting the public when the disease is this serious. So if someone does not follow voluntary measures, that's when more restrictive measures are imposed.
And again, we don't know the exact facts in this case, but perhaps a miscommunication on the seriousness of these advisories suggests that things might be spelled out more clearly in the future.
I agree. I mean, I certainly don't know all the facts here, but there are plenty of teachable moments for all of us in public health, in medicine, in ethics, as we hear even the questions being raised. And I think what you just said is an important one, which is the public may not understand how TB is transmitted, what the difference is between infection and illness, and certainly how serious different forms of TB are. Certainly when we're dealing with something that is this serious for the public's health, it's very important to communicate clearly, to make sure people understand, to repeat things, and to not come across as you have option A or you have option B. Here it is. It's really up to you, to be much more directive.
Nancy Cass, thanks for your time today. Nancy Kess, Phoebe Berman, Professor of Bioethics and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. She joined us from WYPR in Baltimore. Dr. Eisman, thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Michael Eisman, Professor of Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, where he specializes in pulmonary and infectious diseases. And he joined us from his office at the National Jewish Medical and Research Center in Denver. When we come back, it's The Political Junkie, 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, this is Neil Conan from NPR News.